But our shenanigans are cheeky and fun.
Yeah, I mean, his shenanigans are cruel and tragic.
Which makes them not shenanigans at all, really.
Evil shenanigans.
I swear to God, I'll pistol whip the next guy that says shenanigans.
Hey, it's Scott Brennan again on the Verbal Shenanigans podcast, episode 21, I'm climbing, I'm getting there. Just came off a great episode this week with my buddy Taryn and my buddy Chris, where we got into some very interesting conversations about race, and they talked to me a little bit about their experiences being Asian and Indian and anything that they've experienced growing up. We talked about spirituality, and best of all, we talked about beer. But today I'm joined by a friend of mine, funny comic, and a fellow teacher, Mr. Steve Schwartz. How you doing, Steve?
Good. How's it going?
Oh, it's going. It's going. It's a good time to get you on. Summer is dwindling down.
yep, counting the days.
I feel like as soon as August 1st comes, it seems to really speed up. And then part of me is always sad, but part of me is also like, oh my God, I need to get paid again.
Oh yeah, I hear you. The summers are rough.
Once you get that, like, you know, you're set up in the summer, you're like, oh, I can get through that first mortgage and the bills. And then once you realize you got to go through two more months of it, like, oh my God.
That's that early September mortgage payment. That is the hardest one to ever pay.
It's so bad. Like, I'm truly expecting to possibly be late on that one.
Gotta look up that late fee.
Yeah. But I'm sure you've worked your share of interesting summer jobs, being a teacher. Like, I am currently working security at the lake, by the lake I live in, which is basically I sit around in a truck and drive around the lake. Which has actually worked well. I mean, I pretty much get paid nothing, but it's worked well because I just sit and write comedy during the day.
Has anything ever happened? Like,
nothing.
Really?
Well, actually, the first day they put me on, I guess kids were breaking in and, like, you know, smoking weed and stuff on the beach at night. On the first day, they put me out in the middle of the woods.
To try to catch them sneaking in?
Yeah, and in the first 5 minutes, two kids snuck in, and I was like, hey, and they basically just ran away. And that's all the action.
You just said, hey.
Yeah, hey guys. That's probably why they ran away. But anyway, Steve, I met you at a open mic at Scotty's, I believe.
Yeah, a couple months ago.
Which has actually turned out to be a great open mic. I don't know if you've been back at all.
I've been back once or twice, yeah.
Doing a very nice job actually getting people, bringing the crowd close to the stage, giving people, like, they don't really bust your balls on time at all, which is wonderful. I'm finding them to be a very supportive crowd. I've actually gotten on board with Johnny Watson and helping him with his radio show and stuff. So
that's good. That's good that you're finding your little niche.
Yeah. But I guess before we really get into anything, I guess we would be remiss if we didn't at least talk about another loss in the comedy world. Big one. Mr. Robin Williams. Was that yesterday or was that 2 days ago?
Right? No, it was yesterday.
Yesterday. Another one gone from addiction and depression. And it's just horrible. This time it was a giant in the comedy business.
Right. And acting also and all those movies.
Everything. Writing, movies, TV.
Right.
And I really don't usually get too involved in celebrity celebrity deaths and gossip, but this one actually seemed to bother me a little bit. I guess partly because you think Robin Williams, you think that super happy, exuberant, fast-paced, very original delivery in both acting and in comedy. And you assume the persona on stage or the persona in movies is similar to his actual, but it turns out, you know, these personal demons again too much, and you just you see it so much in the comedy world.
Right, know? And it's also odd, I think, different than a lot of the others, is that he's was in his 60s.
Right.
When a lot of the times it's guys in their 20s and their 30s right. that flame out because they've been
drugging
alcohol since a young age. It catches up to them. So.
Yeah, you know, it's sad. It makes you wonder if it's been a whole life deal or, you know, just in recent years or if drinking and drugs seriously just caught up after a while.
Yeah, I don't know. I probably will all come out
mm-hmm.
at some point, but it was so surprising because I don't think anybody suspected it, which means whatever he was going through was sort of private. So I think unless the people close to him open up, you may not know.
Yeah. I mean, I remember hearing that he was battling depression years ago, but you didn't really hear much about it. Usually, I guess you really won't. But, you know, very sad. You know, he's a guy that, you know, I feel like he picked his roles pretty nicely for the most part. Definitely has some, you know, lasting roles that he'll be remembered for. And, you know, he's one of those guys that I guess he doesn't do stand-up too often anymore, but when he does, he just, you know, he was just one of the giants. He's one of the giants up there with Seinfeld and all them guys. And as far as recognizability and talent and
length of career,
exactly. I mean, you're going from Good Morning.
When I was a kid.
Yeah, Good Morning Vietnam, the 70s.
Mork and Mindy when I was a kid. I mean, I was 10 years old.
And, of course, he had duds along the way, but you know, things to me, like I'm a big fan of Good Will Hunting, his role in that
right.
movie. Big fan of, big fan of Hook, his role in Hook.
Right, all the Facebook posts, I hadn't seen that one mentioned, so that's the first.
I even liked Patch Adams. You know, the movie is a little weird, but I thought his role was great in it. Yeah, you know, definitely sad. Were you a big Robin Williams fan, or?
You know, I think I was more when I was younger. Mm-hmm. When I was a kid, I loved Mork and Mindy. And then as a young adult, I liked to stand up and, you know, some of his movies. But he wasn't a great influence on me, but I can certainly understand why a lot of people are upset and miss him and miss his talents. And again, you know, like I said, because he was older and also it seemed like you mentioned something about him picking and choosing his roles. And I think people associate that kind of when you're really that careful with your career, they associate that with you kind of having things together.
That's a good point. I guess not. I mean, he hasn't really been in the spotlight too much recently that I can remember. But I'm pretty terrible when it comes to the celebrity and movie world these days.
Unfortunately, I'm not there to pick you up. I am too.
Like I think the last movie I saw in theaters was Wolf of Wall Street, and before that was probably Batman. So that's like I don't know, a couple years now already. I haven't seen too much film at all lately.
I've seen some kids movies. That's about it.
Well, I'm sure you get to see your share of those. But anyway, not to keep the mood as depressing as Robin Williams, but he will surely be missed by the comedy world especially. And I think mainly whether you're a giant fan or not, you could tell that he was 100% unique. I mean, I can't really think of too many comedians I would say that were similar to him.
No, I can't think of any. No, definitely unique.
That delivery.
His level, and that level of energy.
Yes. But he will definitely be missed. But it seems in this world of comedy, it's almost scary to start getting into. You know, it's like Jesus, like there's so many of them go.
Well, you know, I said to somebody the other day, I said, if you're a really happy-go-lucky person, you can get on stage and try to become a comic if you want, and talk about how things are great and beautiful. No one's going to laugh. You know, you need to have some darkness inside of you somewhere. I think it doesn't have to be crippling, but you have to have some dark side to find the humor in life.
Right. And also the humor in terrible situations.
Right, right.
And, you know, the best comedy usually comes from, well, to me anyway, like the most personal stuff. Like when you relate directly to a comedian on stage, you know within the first 10 minutes of their set if they're telling the truth, if they're really coming from
coming from somewhere where they're writing about their own personal life, you know, like, of course they're going to throw in jokes and exaggerate things, but I feel like the best comedy comes from really unique situations and almost seeing, I feel like a lot of people almost use comedy as therapy, making light of it, but it seems like a lot of them, when those doors close at night and they're off the stage and they're out of the spotlight, then the darkness really tends to set in.
Yeah, I think you're right. I've read a lot of stories about comedians being very difficult to live with, that they're very happy-go-lucky and on stage. You know, they're happy when they're entertaining an audience, but when they're off stage, they're very dark and moody.
Yeah.
The most successful ones, that is.
Yeah. I was thinking about this today, I guess because of the Robin Williams things, but I was thinking, do you think it's that more comedians kill themselves, or do you think it seems like that because when you're a comedian, it's a one-man act. You know, like, for instance, what I mean is, like, if you're in a band, right, and someone kills themselves, a drummer or a bassist or something like that, there's still those members of the band that can carry on the act or can almost speak for the person or keep that person's memory alive. When a comedian goes, that's it. That act is gone, you know, like, it awful, got, like, out. So I don't know. I always wondered if it is comedians or if it is just that it's that solo aspect that when they're gone, that you'll never see that again.
Could be a combination of both.
Right.
Because I'm trying to think about how many bands that you know of where someone in the band has died.
Right. Or movie stars.
Right. It doesn't happen all that often. And when it does happen, sometimes it's an accident. Sometimes it's drugs. But you don't hear about it much. When you hear about it with bands, it's usually bands that are like on the fringe of being popular. Mm-hmm. But it seems with comics, it's a lot of really high-profile comics that die from, you know, drugs and alcohol or and whatever depression comes from that or what have you.
I think a lot of it comes with the lifestyle,
right.
The even just the hours of comedy. You're not doing comedy 9 to 5. You're doing it in clubs or surrounded by alcohol, surrounded by drugs, late nights, you know. So, I mean, I guess it all factors in. But, you know, as far as entertainment, I think we lost 3 giants this year. Robin Williams, Philip Seymour Hoffman, and Harold Ramis. That's a rough year right there.
Yeah. Harold Ramis especially, because I'm a little older than you, and I grew up watching SCTV, and he was on that. And that I used to sneak and stay up and watch that show, and I just thought he was the funniest. And then, you know, the movies he was in, just a great writer, a hilarious actor.
Director.
Right, and director, and just, yeah, that's just, you know, this, you know, being in, I guess he was in his 60s too, like Robin Williams, and that's just way too young. Mm. I think Philip Seymour Hoffman was in his 40s, which is crazy.
And he's another one, Addiction got another one, you know, like, it was just these immensely talented guys. Look at all 3 of them, and like we were talking a couple minutes ago about choosing your roles and diversifying, the 3 of them. I mean, that is 3 examples of guys who did so many different things. So many different things. Philip Seymour Hoffman alone, no role ever seemed the same. Harold Ramis, you know, whether it's directing, whether it's whether it was acting, you know, he did so many different things. And it's just, I the only way I can describe that is 3 giants were lost this year. 3 giants.
Right.
That I respected all of them, and for different reasons, you know, for totally different reasons.
Yeah, yes, 3 different, yeah, for Harold Ramis certainly had maybe, Harold Ramis and Robin Williams was no more for a stand-up. Harold Ramis was a great sketch comedy writer and actor and then director and just, you know, actor in movies also. But you're absolutely right.
Hoffman, just his roles, his side characters, his supporting roles, like, so diverse, you know. And it's a shame, but life goes on. But anyway, Steve, you, let's see. I guess we could start with your teaching.
Sure.
You are a fellow teacher, which is why I thought you'd be a great guest, because we share that bond. We share that in commonality in both, you know, trying to do comedy, trying to balance it with teaching. But first off, how long have you been teaching? What do you teach?
I've been teaching for 20 years, actually 21 years, geez. And I started off teaching middle school language arts and social studies.
Okay.
Then when I was engaged, I needed extra money, you know, to get married, to get a house. So I started adjuncting at Raritan Valley Community College in the computer department. And I was all self-taught.
Nice.
All self-taught. And then I adjuncted there for a few years. I left public school, worked as a programmer, and then I was hired a year later to be a full-time teacher in the computer department at the college, and that was in the fall of 2001. So I've been there for 13 years.
Okay, so you're currently in the college.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
So I've even seen a little bit of everything between being in the middle school and
– Yeah, I also taught elementary school computers.
Nice. That's a job I'd like to do still. I actually applied last year, but it turned out that it wasn't actually computers. It was more like keyboarding, and I would
– You don't want to do – you do not want to do that.
I might have been the next one.
I'm telling you. I don't want to make light of it, but that is a very mind-numbing job.
Oh, well, I turned it down. They offered
good. Good choice. Good choice, my man.
But why'd you get into teaching?
You know, I graduated with a degree in public relations communications, and I tried it for a few months, and it was awful.
Sounds
and
familiar.
I wound up – what was that?
I'm sorry. Familiar. I got my communications degree also.
Oh, there you go. See, you know, it always – you know, the classes are great. The classes are great.
So
working
great.
In the field, not as great at all.
Yeah, see, so I went for mostly – I really wanted to do TV and video. And I worked at a local TV station for a while. I loved it. I still stay in touch with the guys, but it just wasn't a career. Like all the bigger, more glamorous things were all freelance work and long, massive hours, no benefits. And, you know, I still stay on it with, you know, even simple things like this, doing the podcast, doing I do like editing for things and still shoot when they need me. But it definitely wasn't the field I felt like I really wanted to pursue. I realized that, just like you, pretty much after a few months, that this is not as easy as it sounds.
Yeah, well, on your end, it's extremely competitive.
Yes.
So that lends itself to, you know, the exploitation with you having to be freelance and not having benefits. So after that, I quit my job, and my dad owned a car wash. So there I was with a college degree drying cars at a car wash. And
perfect.
Yeah, I was at, you know, speaking of depression, I got pretty darn depressed, I have to tell you.
Right.
So
out of college.
You know, my mom actually gave me an article about how people going back into teaching as a second career, and it just like a light bulb went off in my head, and I went to grad school and got a degree in teaching, and the September after I graduated, I got a job in Hillsboro teaching seventh grade.
In college and coming out of college, teaching wasn't even a thought yet.
No, it wasn't. It never, ever crossed. And to be honest, I probably wouldn't have done it, because when I was in college, I was in a fraternity. I liked to drink six nights a week.
Mm-hmm.
And there was no way I was going to be able to get up and student teach. So I really was too immature at that time. So I did it later. You know, I went to school later when I was 25. So it was much better timing. I was a lot more mature and ready for it.
Right. Sometimes I find that like a scenario like yours sometimes makes way better teachers. Now, because you come in with some real world experience, especially where you're at now, college kids. I as a college, you know, if I could go back, whatever it is, 10 years or so, and a lot of the professors that worked in the field or changed careers were very interesting to me. You know, they cut their teeth a little bit doing other things, and then they realized maybe their passion somewhere else. Or maybe they fell into something by accident, you know, and they're able to, and then they just find what they love to do.
Yeah, I think it helps tremendously. I think as a guy especially, to be a little bit more mature, and certainly if you have life experience working in the field that you go in and teach, then it enhances your credibility, and you can draw from examples and experiences and bring those into the classroom. So I think on that end, you know, if it's a second career, then it's certainly, I think it's good for the students. Mm-hmm. In that regard, to have somebody who's done the thing that they're talking about. Is that what you're getting at?
Pretty much, exactly. Like, when you find, like, your professor or even your teacher at a young – it could be young. You could be in college, high school. I find that when kids are able to almost connect and see that a teacher's dropping their guard a little bit, like, will actually talk about things in their personal life or – share experiences, I feel like the level of respect jumps up tenfold. Like, for instance, I do fifth grade, and in the last 3 years, I've just been telling stories and showing pictures, and whether it's videos of my dog or pictures of a vacation I went on, and the kids love it. I mean, they will ask me, like, can you show me that again? Can we see that at the end of the day? Like, and I found it has such an impact on the classroom environment. I don't know whether it's like a trust thing, or a lot of them, it's like, holy crap, you're a real person. This is a funny little story. One day I was showing them a video of my dog doing a trick. He was like rolling over or whatever. And one of the kids focused on the background and saw like my TV, and I had like an Xbox. And he goes, oh my God, you have an Xbox and a flat screen TV? Like, like, yes, I do. I am a real, I don't sleep in the classroom. I don't just read textbooks all day long. I actually have a personal life, and they seem to love it. I don't know if you see that too, but.
I think, well, when I taught sixth grade, I definitely had very, very similar stories to yours. I think it has a lot to do with the age level, mm-hmm. but it also shows that you connected with them before that, and they liked you as a teacher, and they wanted to know more about you, because if they didn't connect with you and you know, respect you and like you as a teacher, I don't think they would have given a rat's ass about yep. whether or not you had an Xbox in the background. But you're a guy that they want to know more about, so when you give that to them, it means a lot to them because they like you as a teacher. So I think Hopefully. That you've built that rapport beforehand. You know what I mean?
It's interesting you say that, because one of my things on my little list here is, teaching from the perspective of a male and working. I mean, personally, I work in a predominantly female school.
Right.
I'm sure you've been there or still are there.
Right.
But it's not a sexist thing. It's not a discriminatory thing. I just think that as a male teacher, we approach things differently, sometimes for better or for worse. Like, when it comes down to paperwork and organization, forget about it. I'm I'm a disaster. Like, my desk,
How are you?
My desk looks like my room when I was 14 years old.
That That's funny.
But as far as delivering lessons and trying to understand the kids and be personal with the kids and having fun in the classroom, I feel like the kids really, really, really feed off of it. And I've always thought that. And I just see such a different approach between, I'm not going to say all females, but a lot of the females and the male teachers. And sometimes it becomes a point of contentment on their side where,
yeah.
I am of the belief you approach it however you are. I've had teachers in my past who were, you know, drill sergeants, everything is their way, you know, but they were wonderful teachers, you know, like, but I've also had teachers who are very more hands-on and group work and things like that, which would I would put myself in that category. And I love them also. So I'm always of the opinion of do what works for you. and try to match your teaching to your personality style, because a lot of it's going to come off as fake if you don't. You know, if I go in 3 weeks and I'm like, I hand them folders with pink and blue and purple labels and have everything in my classroom labeled like to a T and things like that, I know that I wouldn't keep that up. I know for a fact I wouldn't.
By the middle of the year, the posters will be hanging on their sides.
Oh, right? The fun pack will be dripping off the wall.
Yeah,
you know?
I hear you. I had that same experience when I was a new teacher in public school. We taught in groups of three, and there was one teacher who would lay into me all the time. Why are you trying to be friends with the kids? You're their teacher. Oh, and she just never, ever let up. And it was just particularly difficult because I was new. So, you know, when you're new, you question yourself. But, you know, that was my approach my whole time teaching public school, and it worked really well for me. And, you know, what you're really doing is, you know, think back to when you were a kid and you remember your fifth grade teacher. Yep. And you're going to remember, you know, just the class environment and the funny things the teacher said and the group projects you did.
Right.
Much more than you're going to remember, you know, the facts and the things you've learned.
I say that
it's a
all
fond
the time.
Memory.
You're going to remember how you were treated, not what you did on a Tuesday. In your geometry lesson, you know, like those things will stay, and yeah, some of them are important, but it's, I think, like, you know, fine, you want to work within the curriculum, but still deliver it your way. And what, you know, I find the kids, they latch on much quicker, and it's not really about being friends with them. I think it's more about being friendly with them.
Yes, definitely. There's a line there for sure.
Of course. So being concerned about what happens in their life and what they're doing, and recognizing that the athlete in the class or the musician in the class and the artist or the girl who can write amazing, you know, building on strengths instead of just trying to homogenize the whole class into one, I want this, I expect this, you know, like, which is why, like, I'm 8 years in now, almost nine, because I did a maternity leave the year before, but my first 4 years and my last 4 years are like night and day. I am a teacher who offers so many options on projects now, so many, I try to let kids almost design what they want to do and report back to me and stuff like that.
That's amazing.
It has changed me so much. It has changed them so much, and my dynamic in the classroom. Trying to be more of the facilitator than the director, you know, like if I can talk for 10 minutes instead of 40 minutes and put the kids to work and then come back and have some kind of wrap up, I find it so much more, at least it works for me. I hope it works for the kids because they seem to like it. So,
that's certainly keeping with the current trend in education at college. They have this thing called the flipped classroom where the students, you know, do those kind of projects and they report back and teach the class. So sounds like you're doing something great. And it's definitely more work on your part, but it sounds like, you know, you're willing to put in that work and it's paying off.
But in a way, to me, it's almost not more work. It's just different work. If that makes any sense. It's, I could give an assignment and collect 20 something papers and go on to the next one and collect and then, you know, but I'm a very big believer in projects, a very big believer in, and very big believer in group work, you know, and that's when it becomes a little hard to put physical letter grades on things, because of course there's going to be a kid who's doing more than the next kid and stuff, and that's where it becomes a little difficult. But, you know, like, I feel like you still have to be yourself. At least while we're still allowed to be ourselves, before you know it, that's going to be gone too.
Yeah, that's another story for another day, for sure.
Yeah, that was on the list too.
oh, okay.
One of the big things I was going to ask you is,
sure,
the biggest changes you see from when you started. When did you start, in the 80s or 90s or?
Oh, teaching?
Yes.
1993.
Okay, so from 93 to 2014, the biggest changes, and of course, I'm sure you see things that go in cycles, things that come back, But as far as whether it's something from the state, whether it's something in the actual system, like, what major changes do you see? Now, I guess you're in college. It might be a little different.
But... Yeah, but I think I can elaborate a little bit. And my wife's also a teacher. The biggest changes that I've seen definitely involve the ease that parents, and in your case, parents, and in my case, students have of reaching the professor. When I first started teaching in public school, they had to call the office, leave a message, then the secretary would put the message in my mailbox, and when I got around to returning the call, I would. Now, today, you've got email. I know teachers give out their cell phone number so you can text. Probably some of them are Facebook friends. They can Facebook message.
Yeah.
The other change that I've seen is certainly much, and this is, you know, this is nothing earth-shattering, much greater level of entitlement.
Agree.
You know, you're going to do, you know, as far as parents go, you're going to do what I want you to do for my child, or I'm going to pull them out for a charter school, or I'm going to pull them out and I'm going to homeschool them. And so they're a lot more demanding when things don't go their way. I think that's the biggest change I've seen. I see a lot more pushback from parents, you know, a lot more anti-education, anti-teacher.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly, our esteemed governor has fueled that fire,
yes,
the anti-teacher movement. So yeah, so basically what I'm saying is it's not as pleasant being a teacher today as it was back then. I don't think the pay is any better now than it was when I started in the early 90s. I know it was really bad in the 80s, but by the time the early 90s rolled around, salaries had gotten decent. So yeah, those are the two biggest things that I've seen. Certainly technology has helped in the classroom.
Mm-hmm.
I know that my daughter's getting every kid in her class, and she's in sixth grade, is getting a Chromebook. Again, though, you know, yeah, that is great. So that's one benefit, the technology.
Yeah, I want to touch on a couple of things you just said.
Sure.
The first thing is the accessibility of the teacher. I 100% agree. We actually at school sometimes we call parents have email balls. because they would never say half the things they would in front of you. And also it's the tone of the emails or the tone of something where that face-to-face contact, that look in someone's eye, that tone of voice, you know what they're saying, or they know they're being serious. Or I'm privileged to work with – I love my principal. He's a young guy. He just gets it. He calls it the 24-hour rule. He says, you know, if you get an email that really upsets you, take a day to respond to it.
Right.
And it really makes sense because it's – you think about it a little bit. You let them cool off a little bit. And a lot of times it's over nothing. And I find that my conference – the biggest – you know, the parents are driving me crazy. They'll come in for a conference and it goes perfectly fine. You know, I say, oh – you know, they are struggling in this. They are goofing around, but I'll give you examples. And it's so much that non-face-to-face contact.
Right.
So many things are lost. Like, you know, I could say a sentence to you over email that you can take so wrong. But in person, I could say it to you differently. I could explain it to you, elaborate. So I see that all the time. And it's definitely – it's tough, but – you know, I've learned that as a first-year teacher, I would respond to people almost instantly and send out more emails than I had to, and I've definitely cut back on that way back. And basically, it's if you need to contact me, I will get back to you. And it definitely I feel like it helps, and it eliminates more problems.
Yeah, a couple – I just wanted to say a couple things. I think that what you do is – it comes with experience. I think you're willing to go – way, way beyond early on, but then you realize that you're going to flame out, you know, if you don't.
And sometimes the fight just isn't worth it.
It's not worth it. Another thing I was going to say was, you can write that email response right away, and I've done that before, but you don't send it.
Right.
Sometimes just writing it is enough. And
it's like a diary.
yeah. And in my case, a lot of times it's students being confrontational with me, or it's college students who show up 6 weeks into an online class and want to know if they can how they can make up the first 6 weeks worth of work. But yeah. You know, you have to just sort of take a deep breath and you know, not fuel the fire. But there really aren't any problems that a face-to-face conversation can't solve 99% of the time.
I really agree all 100%. It takes. The other thing you had said is the entitlement, and that is, you know, I work in a pretty affluent district, and I see that so much. It's what did you do wrong? Well, no, it's maybe what did your child do wrong? Or, you know, a lot of these things are in place to help your child. I wouldn't be contacting you if I didn't care or wasn't telling the truth. Like, there's no benefit to me.
Right.
Big thing I see is I coach soccer at the high school, and it's interesting. I just started this week again, and I got 40-something freshmen. I coach freshmen. I have 40-something freshmen coming out, which means indefinitely some cutting, and I've already got that feeling in my throat, like, oh, here we go.
Oh, boy.
You know, like, and it's just I want to say to the parents, like, look, I can't run an efficient practice with 40-something kids and one guy. Second off, if your kid's not going to see the field, if he's, you know, it's also going to take away the kids who are at a higher level. It's also high school sports. It's an everyday thing. It's not a rec thing. It's and I already got that like agita thinking about the next couple weeks.
I don't envy you.
Yep.
What but is the final roster size?
I want to keep 20.
Okay.
If there's 21, 22 that I can use, I'll keep them. But, you know, it's almost a disservice to the kid if they're just coming every day and never going to play. And of course, I'll probably lose some good kids. But that is the world of – that's the real world. That's the real world. You're competing against each other, unfortunately. It's not rec soccer where you pay to play. It's, you know, you got to step the level up a little bit.
Right. I think as freshmen, that's for some of them, it's going to be the first time they experienced being cut, which probably makes it even worse for you.
Yes, yes. And in past years, I haven't had to cut because I've never had this amount come out. But we'll
maybe
see.
Maybe some will quit, hopefully.
Well, yeah, we got two more. Next week is like super hard fitness.
Yeah, work them extra hard.
So I'm thinking a couple will fizzle out. But we'll see. We'll see how that goes. I'm not looking forward to that. But last thing on teaching. Where you are today as a teacher, three pros that you would say that you still like about your job.
I do. I like interacting with students face to face when they're interested and they want to learn. I also like hearing from students who are able to leave the community college and transfer to good schools. You know, especially kids who really don't have, you know, a lot of money, didn't come from a lot, came from some tough backgrounds, who really pick themselves up.
Right. Find themselves.
Right. And you know, and part of my job teaching computers, you know, involves keeping up with the latest technology, the latest trends, even the social issues we talk a lot about. Mm-hmm. So we talk about Facebook in class, and those are things that interest me. Talk about how you know, potential employers are looking at your Facebook account. So I read the top technology news. I bookmark a lot of pages, and I can incorporate that into the class. And it really is it combines my interests, my personal interests, with my job, which is always a good thing to be able to do.
Yes. So I guess that's two.
I thought it was three. It was success stories.
Maybe you extended the second one.
Yeah, I think I flushed out the second two. So I had success stories. I had interacting. You're right, interacting with the students.
Oh, you did have personal stories. Interest.
Yeah.
I'll give it to you.
Okay.
I'll give you the point. Three cons. Three things you do not like. Where it's going, where you are, what you're doing, anything you've seen.
Well, I think what happens is that it, on the college level, more and more classes than ever before are being taught by adjuncts. and they're being exploited. So they don't get health benefits. They only get paid to teach a class. Some of them are teaching three classes, and they're getting paid very little money. Mm-hmm. And so I guess the only downside to full-timers is that a lot of the administrative and committee work is passed down to them. I would say another negative to teaching would be, you know, certainly that it's probably always been this way, but, salary level, it's consistent, but, it's difficult to live a middle class life on a teacher's salary. I would say the third is going back to something I said earlier a little bit, is that there just seems to be a less respect towards educators as before. And all you have to do is read, the comment section of any article. Like I said, where Christy talks about teachers, or any teacher is up to anything, that's no good. No. And just people just lay into teachers. They work 6 hours a day and they have summers off. And it's just, those are the three cons.
Beautiful. Going into, I guess, the next phase is comedy. So when did you start trying to do comedy, and why?
I really didn't think about comedy until probably early 2012. Mm-hmm. And then I took a comedy class in the summer of 2012. And the main reason I did it was because I had two students in one of my summer classes. I remember it was a guy and his girlfriend, and they just were, anytime I assigned something, they were just very just obnoxious and smug and condescending. And I remember the guy said to me, "You realize this is all busy work, don't you?"
Right.
And I just said, I want to be around people that appreciate my presence. I said, I think I'm going to try stand-up comedy, which is incredibly naive when you consider that to try to get an audience to listen to you tell jokes is so much harder than trying to get a classroom of students to listen to you.
I've said this on the podcast many times. Doing stand-up, I used to do it when I was younger, right out of college, and then kind of like a rebirth this last year or so. Doing stand-up is the hardest, but also the most rewarding thing I've done. It's so frightening and so beautiful at the same time, because you're alone, you're not behind a band, you're not in an art exhibit, you're alone on stage with people looking at you, and you are trying to relate to that audience and get them to join you in some kind of experience, but I love it. I love every second of it. I love writing, I love editing, I love even the feeling of, I don't love bombing, but I love I love knowing that it can get better. Like, it's always a work in progress. And I don't know, maybe it's a sadistic thing, but I don't know.
But I was thinking while you were talking, mm-hmm. and I was thinking to myself, boy, I take bombing a lot harder than Scott does. But it's a long journey, and it is it's great to see yourself progress, to see the people that you've become friends with progress, and you do you have a lot of good times, you have rough times, and it just, if you can keep going up on stage after having bombing and having bad sets, it just, to me, I don't think there are tougher people than people who can, all right, I'd say if you're in the military and you're fighting, you're tougher. But let's take
different
that
kind
out of
tough.
The right. It's a different kind of tough. Your mental toughness that it takes to continue to go up on stage, and also ignorance, because you're so bad when you start out, but you have to convince yourself that you're kind of okay to keep going on at it and not realize.
You've got to believe in yourself.
Yeah,
you have to
believe in yourself.
You're forced to.
And then when you get a little bit better, you say to yourself, "Oh my God, I was so awful." And then you get better, and then you just keep saying that to yourself, and it's just, I think it's You know, when you can start getting a laugh from somebody who doesn't know you, or a group of people who don't know you, it's just it's an amazing thing. And when you go into different clubs and different bars and restaurants and all the different environments and variables and trying to adjust, it really improves your mental toughness and I think it can really improve your self-esteem, because you're really doing something very, very difficult. And
yes,
people, what I keep hearing over and over again lately, which is the only way you will fail at stand-up comedy is if you quit. So as long as you keep doing it, you know, you're not failing.
Yeah.
You keep working at it.
It's funny you say that, like, about the bombing thing. I've kind of developed, you know, just through talking to people and working with people, I've kind of developed my own theory on bombing. It's like 2 weeks ago, I had Joe Fernandez on the podcast, and we talked a little bit about bombing.
Yeah, he's a great guy.
Yeah, he's an excellent guy. I've known him for almost 10 years now. We talked about bombing, and I forget what comedian he said had a quote about it, but he said, you know, when you kill on stage, you're not learning anything. Of course, it's the most amazing feeling, but when you bomb on stage, and if you have like the mental capacity to be like, okay, shit, I bombed, but what went wrong? Can I listen back to my stuff and edit? Like, why did it go wrong? Was it the crowd? Was it me? Was it the delivery? Was I too wordy? Like, when you can have that ability to self-edit, and also I think it's an acceptance thing. You have to accept that you are going to go up on that stage and bomb. It's going to happen. It happens to the best guys out there. You know, they still talk about going up on stage and working on new material and just bombing. Of course, they probably get laughs just because they're who they are, but that only lasts a couple minutes. If the material's not there and the delivery's not there, it's going to bomb. And I feel like I've strayed away from it and was so upset about it. Now I'm like, I'm very accepting of it. It's okay. It's okay to me. And I think it makes me a much better writer.
Yeah, you're right. You learn a tremendous amount when you bomb. You have to go back and you have to figure out what went wrong. And then when you come back stronger and you do well the next time, it feels even better. But that, I think the key, though, at least for me with bombing, is you have to try to figure out, you know, what you did wrong and where you could improve on, if there is something that you're able to pinpoint.
I agree.
I've come back with some of my stronger sets after bombing. But I don't know, it's me, it's my personality. As I'm bombing and right after, I take it really hard. I regroup the next day, but boy, that day,
yeah,
I take it harder than I should. And that's, you know, that's my personality flaw.
Well, yeah, I mean, everyone's different, but I mean, I think when you're able to drop that guard, drop that wall of thinking that your material is so amazing and why didn't they laugh? Well, maybe it's something I did. Most likely, 90% of the time, it is something I did. I didn't tell it right. I didn't pause here. I rushed it. I was nervous on stage. I was stiff. And just analyzing those things, I think, is such a learning experience. And where I'm at, it's just, you know, like, that is the growing process. I'm not doing arenas and things like that.
Right.
If four people, watch me bomb, that is not a big deal.
Right.
You know, if I'm bombing and I can learn from it, it's fine.
Right.
Because every guy before me, every guy going on after me has been in the same place. And it's just, I think it just makes my material stronger. What I'm finding is writing with people has really, really helped me a lot.
Are you in a writing group?
No, but I have two comedians I've been working with.
Oh, good.
One at a pretty high level, one at a little bit lower level or same level as me. But you find a group of brutal honesty, telling you, hey, look, I didn't understand that. Or, hey, sometimes flat out, that sucks. I don't get it, you know. does it suck to hear? Of course, because you're working when you're in that moment and you're writing and you're thinking right. and you're going, this is freaking, this is great. This is top notch stuff. Like mm-hmm. no one's going to have this kind of material. And then you hear from someone else and go, eh, you know, and not to say that they're always right or wrong, but you also have to think about that's your little audience for the moment. And maybe they're right. But it's worked out so well because I've given pointers to people who are above me, and they like totally respect me for that because it's not like sucking up to them. It's, hey, I didn't really understand that punchline, or you know, or you don't look right doing that. And it's really good growing experience, and I'm enjoying every second of it. So
yeah, you're lucky to have that.
Yeah, well, we could always give it a shot and write together.
Sure.
Yeah.
That sounds great.
Next question was me. Next question on my list was, where do you get a lot of your material from?
Well, my material, a lot of it is about teaching. Mm-hmm. And it's pretty much morphed into teaching and my personal life. And a lot of it is...
sounds like we have... some similar, yeah, pretty much yeah. where mine is coming yeah. from, really. My relationship with my wife and my family and teaching are pretty much my material
right,
at this point.
Right, right. And I tend to group those two different sets of jokes together. And a lot of times it is a fragment of truth, something that's happened that in and of itself isn't all that funny, so I maybe exaggerate it a little bit to try to make it into a joke. Like I've had students that fall asleep in class, and that's always bothered me. And so I was able to finally write a joke about that by twisting it into a scenario, you know, that was kind of ridiculous, mm-hmm. but funny at the same time. So that's bronies. Kind of what's worked for me. Oh yeah. And the brony joke, I did have a student that was a brony, but clearly I didn't bring him. I have in my joke, I bring him ponies and bullies beat him up and none of that happened. But the idea of a student being a brony was like, I knew that there was a joke there somewhere, but just the fact of having one is in and of itself funny. Of course. So,
just, the, I mean, freaking the word alone makes me giggle. I'm a brony.
Right. I mean, yeah. I mean, it's I think, you know, I give the guy credit. It's got to be incredibly brave. And, you know, everybody's, you know, we're teachers, so we're liberals and we're understanding. So that's kind of like, you know, when you're a teacher and you're a comic, you kind of toe that line where you're, you know, you can poke fun of it, but while at the same time, you're not putting it down and being, you know, sort of conservative and not understanding. At least, and I think that's how my, and it's not even intentional, that's kind of how the jokes come out. That you poke fun at something, but you're not necessarily putting it down.
It's interesting, because you're almost like guiding this interview, almost exactly what I have written down.
Oh, great.
The next thing was the balance between teaching and comedy. Do you share that with your kids, or do you keep that life separate?
Well, you know, the only problem is that I started running some shows at my college.
Okay.
So because of that, you know, there is some overlap, but I don't really advertise it in my classes. Because you know, I don't want them, for a couple of reasons. Number one, I don't want it to look like I'm bragging, although there's really, quite frankly, nothing to brag about at this point. Right. But I also don't want to, you know, I don't want them to think I'm going to come in and I'm going to, you know, enter, you know, start telling jokes. So I try to keep it separate. I have hosted at my shows, but I, you know, I've tried to stay away from actually doing material. It's kind of, I haven't found the comfort level yet. I think this year I'll do a better job. You know, maybe letting loose a little bit more, because mm-hmm. if it's during a show, it's, you know, it's a separate event. But so, yeah, I mean, it's, you know, I try to keep it separate as much as I can.
I agree. I even try to keep it separate from the people I work with. But
they've
found their way.
For why is that the case?
You know, I think part of it is me. It's a self-conscious thing. I'm sure you have experienced this where people go, oh, you're a comic. What do you talk about? What are your jokes? Tell me a joke.
Yeah, that's the worst thing.
That's the worst thing. It's like, well, it's all builds on it. They're not like knock-knock jokes or one-liners, right. You know, like –
Either that or you could put this in your act.
Yeah.
Another annoying one.
But I also think it's it just comes down to me. It's maybe it's part of me not wanting to invite everyone out to till I feel like I'm hitting it on all cylinders. Because currently I'm not. I mean, I've had some great shows, some great experiences, especially this summer. But I'm already finding some inner battle with my material and myself lately. And the material I'm writing is, I love it so much more, but I'm not doing it enough where I'm getting to perform it to where I want to do it till I feel comfortable that I'm doing it all the time. I don't know. I guess more of it's just me. It's not really the people I work with. It's just me. It's almost like, when I was in bands, like, if I didn't feel like we were ready, I would like only invite certain people to shows, you know, like,
yes,
I don't know. And I don't want them to all come out to, but this is kind of a selfish reason because you know, we're at that point where you play occasional shows that are bringers.
Right, so, you're saving up your bringers.
Right. I'm kind of trying to diversify.
That's very smart.
Yeah.
That's very smart.
Because, you know, after the first time, even if you're good, it's going to be hard to get people to drop their lives again and come see me for 10 minutes, you know, like, or whatever it is. So I guess that's all on me, actually. But
that's actually pretty smart. You're saving it up. And this way, their first impression of you will be as a comic who's going to be further down the road than it would have been if they saw you when you were newer.
Right.
And I made that mistake. I had people coming to see me when I was very early on, and that was – now, you know, I can't get those people to come see me, not necessarily because they still think I'm there, but because, you know, people are willing to come out and see you, you know, once, maybe twice, and then that's it. You know, mm-hmm. They have other things to do. And it's not cheap to come see you.
No, that's the thing. It's, you know, $10, $15 plus two drinks or whatever it is. And it becomes a lot. It becomes a lot to ask, you know, especially, like, when they're not seeing top-notch entertainment, and you know, a lot of it's still a work in progress as far
right
as,
you know. Right,
so you know, as far as comedy, best show you played, worst show you played?
All right,
they could be open mics too, like, okay, I my personal I told on the podcast was doing comedy at a pizzeria with eight guys who were there for open mic playing Bob Dylan songs.
Oh really?
And it actually wasn't bad. It was just bad that I thought that it was going to be a comedy audience.
That was your worst, you just said, or your best?
That was my worst, because I was shell shocked when I got there.
That's not a bad worst one, because that was your environment more than it was you. My best one was actually, I think, Sunday at Tierney's.
Yeah,
because
this Sunday.
Yeah, this past Sunday. You're there this Sunday?
Mm-hmm.
All right, good luck.
Yeah, I've been there. This is my third time there.
Yeah, you're getting to be a veteran. Oh, so yes. I went up there, and I had a strong set. There were some audience members who were yelling stuff out at me, and I was handling it and just throwing stuff right back at them. I came up strong. Mm-hmm. One of the criticisms I've had from my tutor is that I don't start off strong enough. I felt like I did. I was a tough audience, and they were laughing, and I got some applause. So it was a really good show from start to finish. And I actually watched it. It was the first time I've ever watched a tape where I felt good watching it. I didn't cringe watching it. So that was my best. My worst was Valentine's Day of this year. I did a show at a restaurant that where the stage is out, you know, it's right near where the tables are. Mm-hmm. So and that's not a great explanation. It's not in a private room. So if you came in to eat, you could sit right near the stage. So theoretically, you could not know there's a comedy show there. Come in and see comedy, which is not all that unique.
I take that back. Mine is also similar to that. I wonder if we're talking about the same place.
But. I picked a scab. This was in Cranberry.
Oh, no.
Okay.
I was talking about the station.
Oh, the station in Garwood?
Yes.
Yeah, this is the station in Cranberry.
Oh, it was like doing comedy in the middle of a TGI Fridays. Like,
oh, yeah, it's the worst.
It's almost better looking in the mirror and doing comedy.
Right. The customers have their backs to you, yep. Right?
Backs to you. All the sports games are still on. Yeah. It's like.
But that's I know we're getting off on a tangent, but I actually like doing that, Mike. On occasion, because it is such a difficult environment that it forces you to find ways to talk to people, yeah. Which expands your horizons. So I don't think that's a mic you would want to do every week, but it's certainly one that every so often you can. I remember a couple times ago I did that mic, and I had all these jokes planned, and there were only two tables listening, and one was full of kids. So I had to cut like 90% of my material out.
Yep.
But so anyway, back to this really bad show. It was Valentine's Day, and this woman was out for her birthday, and she was probably in her 60s, and they all had these really – and she had probably 20 people with her, and they all had these really ugly Valentine sweaters. Mm. It just was – and they looked so serious, and they looked so dour. And I even though it was just 6 months ago, I had zero crowd work skills at the time. And I tried to go through my material, and it was just crickets. And there was one joke I told, and halfway across the room, I heard a woman say to her friend, "That's not funny." And I just got through my material. I don't know how I did it. I got off the stage, and it was just brutal.
Yeah.
Brutal. And it was, it was just a combination of a bad audience and really me, who didn't have the skills. And other comics didn't do great on the material, but they were more experienced and they had the crowd work skills. So they started asking questions and goofing on people, and they were able to salvage their sets.
Right. All right. Coming to the end here, I just got a couple of news stories that I find funny. First one here, Steve, is a knife falls from the sky into a Chinese man's head. some people get hit in the head by stray frisbees. Others get stabbed by a knife plummeting through the air. It appears that was the case for a 57-year-old Chinese man, probably butcher's name, Zunzi Zhao. The Telegraph reports that Zhao was casually walking in his hometown of Guanyin when he noticed a knife protruding from his head.
Didn't feel the knife hit him?
Well, according to the story. So where did the knife come from? Apparently, as Zhao was walking underneath a high-rise apartment building, the knife fell from an eighth-floor balcony in what has to be one of the worst cases of timing ever. He said he felt a very heavy weight before bystanders pointed out that he was bleeding. "It hurts a lot," Zhao told the station from the hospital. "I cried out, 'My head hurts,' but I did not know what had happened." Only hours after the incident, doctors were able to remove the knife from his head. Police said that the knife had been knocked over at the ledge, and Zhao is in stable condition.
Oh, my goodness.
And there's a picture of him with a straight-up knife blade in the back of his head. So, you know, when you're thinking about bombing and how bad your life is,
things can always be worse.
Yes. The next one, Steve, is man fined for pretending to be a ghost at a cemetery, making woo noises around mourners.
Oh my God!
What a ghouligan! Huh? What a great punchline there. An unemployed British man from Portsmouth was arrested April 29th and later fined after pretending to be a ghost near mourners at a grave, according to the Portsmouth News. While a nearby family was paying their respects to a lost loved one at Kingston Cemetery, a drunk 24-year-old Anthony Stoller was throwing himself backwards, waving his arms about and going, "Woo," the attorney said. Prior to his Oh God, they got all sorts of puns in it. Prior to his boorish behavior, Stallard was seen kicking a ball around with a friend near the graves. While the football was going on, the defendant was effectively singing loudly and being disrespectful in among the graves. Stallard was fined £35, which is about $58, for using threatening or abusive words or behavior likely to cause distress.
Yeah, so I don't really know what
either this guy's drunk, one, two, hilarious, or three, just, I don't know, not in touch with himself and just decided.
Fearless, that, too, right?
Yeah, fearless. Making woo noise. That's the best headline. So lastly, Steve, I always do a segment called Dirtbag of the Week, or most of the times, and I find a story where this one, the dirtbag can go either way.
Dirtbag of the Week.
And the title is Woman Confesses to Filming Porn in the Church After Tipster Recognizes Her Breasts. So, this isn't your run-of-the-mill confession. A woman in Austria admitted to filming a pornographic video inside a church after a tipster recognized her breasts. In a video posted online, the woman whose face is not shown undoes her top and caresses her breasts while holding what appears to be a Bible and a rosary. The New York Daily News reported that at least two porn videos featuring the same woman were filmed at the same church in June. According to Austrian Times, Bernard Power, a priest of the diocese, went to police after they said they recognized their church in the video. After the footage was screened on local television, a tipster came forward and said he recognized the woman's breasts. Horsham police were then able to track down the 24-year-old amateur video star who confessed. She now faces charges of offending religious feeling and desecration of a church. Now, the way I saw it, there could be several dirtbags in this story. One, obviously the woman doing the crime.
Right.
Two, the priest who said that he saw the video, which I find a little ironic. And then three, the guy who was able to recognize the woman's breasts without seeing her face.
He's my nominee.
He's your nominee?
Yeah, how many, because I have to ask you, how many times do you have to see somebody's breasts before you could actually recognize them?
I don't
know. So that guy watches an outrageous amount of porn.
Yeah, like I don't even know if I'd recognize my body on video.
Yeah, I'm saying, how do you recognize someone else's boobs without seeing their face? I don't know.
All right, so by your nomination, Steve, the guy, not the woman who is in the video, the guy who is the tipster, whose name is anonymous.
It's creepier. I think he's creepier than her.
I agree. The fact that he really had to be observing him. But
and two, he ratted on her, too. He ratted on her.
That's... But two, also, they must have been out there a lot, is what I would think, or, you know, in the eye of people to be really recognizable. I wonder what they left out of the story. Like, does he recognize them from church or does he recognize them from other videos?
Right. Or from dating her.
Yes. Watch, it's like an ex-girlfriend of his or something.
Right. That's not clear.
Well,
he batted her out, man. Why would he do that?
I know. Think about she could have put out 10 videos.
Ruined it for everyone.
Yes. All right, Steve. It was a pleasure having you on the podcast.
Same here. Thank you so much.
You are welcome back anytime. We can talk anything. We don't have to talk about just teaching and comedy. But lately, this podcast has turned into like the it's like the Dirty Jobs of podcasts. I just find someone I think is interesting, who has something to talk about, who has a point of view. Whether it's a comedian, a musician, some old friends, whatever it is, the podcast is definitely evolving a little bit, which is cool.
That's good, and you're really. I think are you doing more than one a week? You're putting a lot of them out there.
When I have the time, I try to do. What I'm really trying to do is have my two buddies who we always seem to have some kind of interesting conversation. If you get a chance and listen to the one right before this, I think you'll find it interesting, especially with the race and spirituality.
Yeah, I'll check it out.
Because it's cool, because it's, you know, I'm a white guy, one's an Indian guy, one's an Asian guy.
Yeah, three totally different perspectives.
Different perspectives. We got pretty deep into freedom of speech, and we got deep into how we were raised and how it affected our spirituality, stuff like that. Very good podcast. It was very much longer than most of them, but it was like one of those conversations where it wasn't worth stopping.
Oh, good. I'll check it out for sure.
Steve, you playing anywhere soon?
Let's see. I guess the one that I could promote would be the I'm playing actually the Somerville. I know Rocco's going to get mad at me. I think it's called the Somerville Street Fair. It is August 21st, Thursday night, and it's outdoors on Division Street in Somerville.
Sounds good.
Yep.
Anything outdoors is nice, especially
Clean comedy.
Clean.
Yep.
Squeaky Complete. Clean.
G-rated.
Wow. Bring the family. Yeah. Bring the kids. Bring grandma. I am at Tierney's Sunday night. Sunday the, what's this, the 17th.
Best of luck.
And I am at Mara's in South Amboy. The show got moved from the 22nd to the 23rd. So please come out. Again, Steve, thank you.
No problem.
Everybody, please subscribe. Please spread it around. Podcast has been going great. Some good guests coming up also in the future. So stay posted. Keep the wind at your back, and I love you.